Good morning and welcome to the Daily Digest from Personalized Intelligence. It's Monday, April 13th, and this is the Macro Geopolitics AI Blockchain Edition, packed with everything you need to navigate a rapidly changing world. I'm Maya.
And I'm Alex. And Maya, I think it's fair to say we've got a lot on the table today. It feels like everything's in flux, really, like a sourdough starter constantly bubbling with new activity. One thing influences another, and you have to understand the whole process to get the right rise.
So let's start with that flux. Geopolitical risk is sending shockwaves through energy markets. Did you know that oil price volatility is currently at a level not seen since, well, before the pandemic? We'll unpack what that means for inflation and who really stands to benefit.
And speaking of benefits, it's not just economics at play. The future of work is here, driven by AI. But are we talking about widespread productivity gains or a massive displacement of talent? We'll be teasing out those complex angles.
Complex indeed. And just when you think you've grasped it, we turn to the really big picture, AI and national security. The US and China are locked in a silent arms race, but what does that actually look like on the ground? I still can't believe the scale of investment.
Worth noting, we'll be diving into the implications of that. It's a conversation we've been waiting to have, frankly. Let's get started.
Victoria Craig flagged an 8% surge in oil prices on April 13, 2026, coinciding with a US Navy blockade of Iranian ports. Let's unpack the intersection of geopolitics and energy markets. It's a mess right now, isn't it?
It absolutely is, and I think it's helpful to frame it as a fundamental shift in the risk landscape. We've moved beyond predictable supply disruptions, demand shocks. This is now about the erosion of safeguards, as Louis Vincent Gave pointed out, like the transferability of bonds to commodities and the reliability of sea lanes. That's a different beast altogether.
Safeguards eroding sounds dramatic. Is that really the case, or are we just being more sensitive to everything because of, well, everything else?
I think it's demonstrably the case. Consider Trump's actions, the tariffs, withdrawal from agreements. Those weren't random acts, they exposed the fragility of the system. And now, with conflicts in Iran and Venezuela heating up, we're seeing the consequences. The market is repricing risk, and that repricing is manifesting in higher energy prices.
Higher energy prices aren't exactly new. The Korean capital gains tax change, incentivizing domestic investment, triggered a mass exodus from foreign assets in December 2023. Is that a model for what we're seeing now? A quiet shift in capital flows.
It's a strong parallel. The Korean example illustrates governments subtly directing savings into domestic bonds, creating artificial demand. That's happening on a larger scale now, driven by national self-sufficiency concerns. The increasing prevalence of drone warfare, as Gave also highlighted, is forcing countries to build domestic inventories and bring capital home. It's a resource grab disguised as national security.
A resource grab, and that's where energy becomes ground zero.
Something to flag here, energy is the lifeblood of any modern economy, and the vulnerability of global seaways is the choke point. That's why we're seeing the energy sector entering a structural bull market, despite short-term volatility. Saresna is right, it's a long-term trend, but one susceptible to unexpected events.
Unexpected events like a US Navy blockade. That feels less unexpected now than it did a week ago.
It's the speed and scope of the escalation that's concerning. And the macroeconomic consequences are significant. Muir anticipates a recession triggered by central bank reactions to higher oil prices, not necessarily the prices themselves. Europe is particularly vulnerable, as he also pointed out, and potentially mispriced as a result.
Mispriced how? Less bad than it looks or more bad than it looks?
More bad, unequivocally. Europe's net energy importer status makes it acutely sensitive to price fluctuations. Look at the new Fortress Energy restructuring, a split into two companies to reduce debt, but at the expense of shareholder equity. That's a symptom of a broader fragility.
So debt reduction, but also a sign of underlying weakness. Nice. What about the market reaction beyond the immediate oil spike?
Record Q1 trading results are expected, driven by volatility, but further escalation could hinder dealmaking. Essentially, the risk premium is increasing, but liquidity is drying up. Lenders are transitioning into ownership roles within distressed companies, but as Weber noted, they're fundamentally unprepared.
Unprepared how? Are they expecting to flip distressed energy companies like a real estate project?
That's the core of the problem. They lack the resource dedication and industry expertise of private equity. They're often caught flat-footed by adverse events, initiating preparation too late in the process. The lack of an owner mindset until a sale process is underway is a critical mistake.
Sounds like a recipe for disaster. It's like bringing a spreadsheet to a gunfight, isn't it?
A remarkably apt analogy. And it's compounded by the fact that restructuring processes often overshadow day-to-day business management. Advisors consume all available resources, leaving management disempowered and lacking clear direction. John F. Weber details this vacuum perfectly, advisors taking over, hindering improvement initiatives.
So everyone's focused on fixing the financials, nobody's focused on running the business. What about the Telesat situation? That feels complicated.
It is.
Reliant on funding from the Canadian government, with its future dependent on the success of its Lightspeed constellation. And as the reports show, the initial board composition was misaligned with operational needs, dominated by restructuring advisors instead of domain experts. A classic case of getting the wrong people in the room.
Speaking of domain experts, does this all mean we should just pile into energy stocks? Saresna thinks so, long-term despite short-term vulnerability.
I agree, but with caveats. The fact that energy stocks are now the best performing sector over multiple timeframes, despite limited broad ownership, raises a concern of interventionist policies. Taxes on profits, export bans, those are inevitable when the trade becomes too popular. That's a risk factor we need to be aware of.
Inevitable intervention, so the government will essentially punish success. Wonderful.
There's a signal here that underscores the importance of understanding the broader macroeconomic context. Muir frames rising energy costs as a broad-based tax on consumers and businesses, regardless of U.S. energy independence. Profits accrue to energy producers, not the wider economy.
A consumer tax disguised as geopolitical risk. Lovely. But you mentioned CTAs being at maximum short positioning in the bond market. Does that matter?
It matters enormously. Nico Leroy's analysis reveals peak short exposure due to inflation fears. This sets up a potentially explosive short covering rally should economic conditions weaken, even temporarily. The bond market is coiled like a spring.
Coiled like a spring, you're on a roll with the imagery today. Is that a realistic scenario given the Fed?
It's a risk.
Patrick Saresna questions whether raising interest rates to combat oil-driven inflation is counterproductive, addressing monetary inflation while exacerbating supply-side constraints. It's a classic policy error, increasing recession risk.
So fighting inflation with a tool that makes inflation worse. That's suboptimal.
Suboptimal is a generous assessment. And it highlights the broader point that fiscal policy exerts a stronger influence on economic outcomes than monetary policy. Trump's war funding, potential stimulus reductions, those factors could override the impact of rate hikes, as Muir details.
Right, the unpredictable nature of fiscal shifts. Which brings us back to the original point, erosion of safeguards. It's not just about oil prices, it's about the fundamental instability of the system.
The data tells a story that instability is amplified by the shift in assumptions underpinning global finance. Previously reliable safeguards, the transferability of bonds, U.S. control of sea lanes, the U.S. as a consistent supporter of the global trading system have eroded. That creates a fucked up, you trusted us dynamic, as Gabe put it.
Charming. So where does that leave us? Is there any good news here?
The good news is that there are opportunities for investors who understand the new risk landscape. Europe's bond market is potentially mispriced, as Muir highlights. And the energy sector, despite short-term vulnerability, offers long-term value. But it requires a proactive, not reactive approach.
Proactive, not reactive, and a healthy dose of skepticism. So to distill everything, the recent geopolitical turmoil isn't just an energy crisis, it's a symptom of a deeper systemic breakdown, a shift in power dynamics, a reassessment of risk, and a growing awareness that the old rules no longer apply.
It's a world where the assumptions we've relied on for decades are crumbling, and the only way to navigate it is to embrace the chaos and prepare for the unexpected.
Which brings us to the future of work. Given that a fundamental renegotiation of global order inevitably reshapes where and how people earn a living. Remember that thread from last week on the gig economy and how we were questioning if it was actually empowering workers? It feels quaint now.
Two things stand out. That debate feels almost analog in light of what's unfolding with AI. The gig economy was about shifting who employed people. This is about shifting if people are employed.
Tom Blomfield, the founder of Monzo, essentially declared income tax dead. Dead? Within 5 to 6 years.
The core of his argument, as I understand it, isn't a political statement, but a purely economic one. He's anticipating a rapid decrease in the labor share of output. If human labor becomes economically irrelevant, the tax base shifts to where the value is being created, the compute itself.
A compute tax? I mean, it sounds sci-fi. But he's not alone, right? This is about the inevitable collapse of the current welfare state model.
It's a logical extension of observing the trends. Since 1980, profits have been accruing to firm owners, alongside a declining labor share. Compute tax levied on data centers or inference tokens is a way to address that imbalance and fund public programs as automation accelerates.
Let's talk numbers. Blomfield mentioned Gary Tan at Y Combinator building something that would have taken 5 years of software engineering in 1 or 2 months, spending $40,000 on coding tokens.
That's the illustrative example. It's a tenfold productivity gain, and we're only seeing the beginning. Consider onshore, revenue per employee is $1 million compared to $100,000 at traditional firms like Deloitte. This isn't incremental improvement, it's a fundamental restructuring of profitability.
Restructuring is a polite word for job losses. He also said Monzo scaling to its current size now would require only 10 to 20% of the workforce it did in 2019.
It's a telling detail. The conventional pyramid structure, many junior employees supporting a few senior professionals, is becoming obsolete. He refers to it as a transition to a pillow structure, significantly reducing the need for entry-level roles. The work is being automated.
Coding apparently is our canary in the coal mine. He predicts 98% of coders aren't using AI tools to their full potential, and demand for human coders will plummet within 18 months.
It's a particularly stark example because coding is so easily quantifiable. But it illustrates a broader point. Elasticity of demand for software will increase, lowering production costs dramatically. But the demand for the labor to produce that software will decrease.
He's worried about governments being dangerously complacent, comparing it to long-tail risks like pandemics or financial crises, and suggesting a 50% probability of catastrophic disruption warrants immediate preparation.
The lack of action is the key concern. He stresses the importance of establishing domestic data centers and aggressively increasing energy production. Failing to do so risks the UK being unable to tax the compute power driving the AI economy. It's a geopolitical argument wrapped in an economic one.
He talked about superintelligent AI arriving faster than anticipated, and specifically called out lawyers and doctors being rendered obsolete within 4 to 5 years. Seriously?
That's where the analysis gets provocative and relies on the observation that humans are surprisingly poor at deep analysis. AI is already outperforming experts in specific tasks. The expectation is widespread access to previously exclusive professional services, intellectual abundance, as he calls it.
That sounds utopian and terrifying. What happens when world-class doctors and lawyers are accessible to everyone, but no one can afford anything else?
That's the intellectual abundance paradox. It necessitates a new economic model to ensure widespread economic dignity despite potential job displacement. The compute tax is a proposed solution, but it's predicated on governments actually acting.
Block, interestingly, seems to be building its entire organizational structure around this inevitability. Jack Dorsey talking about replacing hierarchy with an intelligence system.
The implication runs deeper. The core function of hierarchy information routing is now achievable by AI. They're building a world model of their operations and customer base, using transaction data as an honest signal for training those systems.
Intelligence layer proactively composing solutions, loans, direct deposit setups without product management decisions. That's not scaling a company, that's building a digital brain.
It's a shift from humans as the coordination mechanism to a system that understands and reacts to the economic graph of its users. They're pursuing speed as a compounding advantage, fueled by the richness of their data, the dual view from Cash App and Square.
So middle management is just gone.
That's the implication. The span of control limitation, forcing layers of management and slowing information flow, is being explicitly solved by AI. Individual contributors can make decisions autonomously based on the context provided by the world model.
And the shadow org chart of specialized AI agents that arises organically. Shipper owning personal accountability for R2C2's mistakes. That's weirdly effective governance.
It establishes reputational skin in the game. Personal ownership creates a trust layer that corporate governance cannot replicate. The mid-journey effect, observing agents tackle sophisticated tasks, raises the capability awareness of the entire team, but only in trusted communities.
Okay, so we're automating jobs, redesigning companies, and potentially replacing entire professions. What's the biggest obstacle beyond government complacency?
The critical gap isn't technological, but imaginative. People need to believe they can delegate tasks to AI. Brandon Gell having the tools but lacking the mindset until a specific circumstance prompted the idea.
The information routing manager is officially obsolete.
Both Block and Every implicitly demonstrate that. The ability to bypass traditional management layers and access information directly through AI agents.
It's all happening so fast. Blomfield suggested revisiting this discussion in October 2026. That's a really short time frame.
He tacitly acknowledges the rapid pace of change. A 5-year window is predicted to yield breakthroughs in biotechnology and drug discovery, driven by AI advancements, potentially democratizing access to expertise.
So to recap, significant restructuring across sectors, potential job displacement, a shift in tax revenue, and a complete reimagining of organizational structures. The one indicator I'd be watching this week is the stock performance of NVIDIA. Specifically, their earnings report on May 22nd. That's a direct measure of investment in the compute power driving this whole revolution.
An excellent signal. And it will directly inform the debate around whether this AI boom is sustainable or merely a temporary shift in capital expenditure cycles. Because the consequences of this aren't just economic, they'll quickly move into the geopolitical arena.
The Biden administration just dropped a national security memorandum on AI. It feels like less a declaration of war and more a really expensive shopping list.
That's a surprisingly apt analogy. Aram Gavoor on Lawfare frames it precisely as a shift from developing the technology to adopting it, a fundamental change. We've historically led the foundational research like with nuclear physics, but AI is different. This memo isn't about building the next GPT-4, it's about integrating it rapidly and scaling its application across defense systems.
Integrating it and presumably spending trillions doing so. 25% of all energy production potentially. Let's be clear, that's not a typo.
Stepping back, that energy demand is driving a reconsideration of nuclear power. It's not just about the monetary cost, but the sheer logistical hurdle of powering these frontier models and the infrastructure surrounding them. The memo understands this isn't about a single breakthrough, it's about sustained capabilities and the infrastructure to maintain them.
Sustained capabilities like making sure the precision missile system works every time, even with monthly software updates.
The pattern is clear, the ambition is for agile defense, a departure from traditional static platforms. Imagine a system like a precision missile that can be retargeted and recalibrated in response to evolving battlefield conditions, not just updated annually, but monthly. The procurement process is being overhauled to prioritize speed, intentionally lowering competition thresholds. Think Lockheed Martin and the SR-71, but with the tech already existing.
So less innovation, more fast adoption of what already is. That sounds fraught with risk.
It does, and the memo acknowledges it. Vendor lock-in is a serious concern, but the rationale is speed is paramount. It's a conscious trade-off. And there's a whole shark effect they're trying to manage, agencies wanting to integrate rapidly, but needing to adhere to safety protocols. M2410 is a major factor there, the new executive order on AI safety.
Because integrating AI also means someone needs to worry about deepfake pornography.
It's a surprisingly prominent concern. The unstated implication, as Gavoor points out, is the need for a consensus advisory framework, likely with a 2-year reauthorization focusing on high-risk use cases. The Sam Altman testimony seems to have informed this, a pragmatic focus on demonstrable risks.
Demonstrate risk. Like a deepfake so convincing it triggers a diplomatic incident.
Potentially. But it's broader than that. Think about the accuracy standards for mission-critical deployments, an aircraft carrier battle group, for example. The memo emphasizes intentioned application of resources, distinguishing between general tools like Copilot and those where failure has catastrophic consequences. They're aiming to avoid repeating the wasteful spending of the post-9/11 era.
Wasteful spending. That's a low bar.
It is, but it highlights a strategic shift in how funds are allocated. And it's not just about domestic capabilities. Sullivan explicitly frames this as vigorous competition alongside strategic alignment, even on issues like fentanyl precursors. It's a nuanced approach, rivalry where necessary, cooperation where possible, and maintaining communication channels to prevent escalation.
Friendly competition with China to stop drugs, and then immediately building better missiles.
That's a somewhat reductive but not inaccurate summation. And a significant element of this competition is talent acquisition. The government is competing with private sector salaries reaching $800,000 for machine learning PhDs, expanding visa categories, and utilizing existing discretionary powers. Both administrations recognize the need to retain skilled workers, even if it requires loosening immigration rules.
$800,000 for a PhD. And then you work for the government and what? You get yelled at in hearings.
The hope is to attract that talent through fellowships and chief AI officer roles, a whole-of-government effort to integrate expertise. The GSA's rapid training programs, as Gavoor highlights, suggest a bipartisan foundation for continued investment, regardless of who's in office.
A bipartisan foundation built on the backs of overworked PhDs and a looming energy crisis.
It's a complex landscape. But crucially, the NSM acts as a permissioning mechanism for Silicon Valley, acknowledging that only a limited number of entities are capable of producing these frontier models and that specialized resources like mass compute and quantum computing are currently held by the U.S. government.
Permissioning mechanism. They're asking nicely for the keys to the kingdom. What happens if China asks even nicer?
That's the core strategic tension. China is investing heavily in robotic foundation models and humanoid robot development, as Sergey Levine discussed. If they achieve comparable compute power and AI talent, the balance shifts. The U.S. strategy is implicitly betting on its existing ecosystem, but also recognizing the need for a global vision of responsible AI governance to exert influence.
Responsible governance. Like, please don't build Skynet China.
A simplified version, perhaps. But it's about setting the standards. The U.S. is leaning on existing privacy concepts and constitutional principles, like free speech, while attempting to balance innovation with security concerns. The long-term implication is a race to define those standards and to ensure alignment with allies.
Define standards while building missiles and managing deepfakes. I foresee three consequences. First, a surge in AI-themed legal battles. Second, an exponential increase in extremely polite international condemnations. And third, my Roomba suddenly developing a complex political ideology.
The legal battles are almost certain. The international condemnations are a given. The Roomba, that's a fascinating and increasingly plausible outcome. Looking ahead, the success of this strategy hinges on the ability to effectively streamline procurement without creating unsustainable vendor dependencies. By December 2024, we should see a clearer picture of which companies are benefiting from these lowered competition thresholds and whether the promise of rapid innovation is actually materializing. That's what to watch.
Looking back at everything, the oil spikes, the Navy blockade feeling a lot less unexpected than it did last week, the $800,000 machine learning PhDs, it all feels less like a collection of isolated events and more like a systemic recalibration, doesn't it? Like the underlying rules of the game are being rewritten.
Consider this, what we're witnessing is a convergence of forces, driven by a fundamental reassessment of baseline geopolitical stability. The predictable energy supply chains we've relied on for decades are fracturing, leading to a systemic repricing of risk. And that repricing isn't contained to commodities. It's radiating outward, influencing everything from capital flows. That Korean capital gains tax change is a subtle signal to the very definition of economic advantage.
And then you throw in AI, which is both accelerating and exacerbating everything. Onshore pulling in $1 million revenue per employee while Deloitte scrapes by at $100,000. That's not just efficiency, that's a total restructuring of the labor market. But it's also fueling a silent tech arms race, right? The $40,000 Gary Tan is spending on coding tokens feels almost quaint compared to the scale of investment happening in national security applications.
And it's a race with incredibly high stakes. The push to integrate AI into defense systems isn't about incremental improvements. It's about establishing a sustained technological advantage. The M2410 executive order on AI safety is a response, but also a reflection of how quickly things are moving. We're seeing a shift from foundational research to practical deployment, and that's where the real competition lies. It feels at times like building a cathedral with acoustics that change while you're laying the stone. The reverberations of each decision are unpredictable.
But then the question becomes, can governments actually adapt? The concerns about job displacement are huge. And even if they do intervene, will those interventions just end up penalizing the very innovation they're trying to foster? You said something earlier about a compute tax. It feels like any attempt to regulate this space will have unintended consequences.
It's a delicate balance, and the risk of policy error is substantial. The predicted recession triggered by central bank reactions, trying to manage supply-side inflation with demand-side tools, feels almost inevitable. But alongside that, we're likely to see a structural bull market in energy, despite the short-term volatility. And the record Q1 trading results we're anticipating, that's likely a short-covering rally predicated on a temporary weakening of economic conditions.
So a lot of turbulence potentially, and a lot of unanswered questions. Is this AI boom sustainable, or is it just a capital expenditure cycle? Are governments dangerously complacent? Can the ecosystem maintain advantage against Chinese competition?
Those are the crucial tensions right now. Ultimately, I think we're heading toward a world where resource control, energy, data, computational power becomes the central determinant of geopolitical power. And the speed at which AI is accelerating that process is frankly a little unnerving.
Thanks for joining us today. We'll be back tomorrow to unpack whatever new layer of complexity the world throws our way.